3 a.m. Tales of Terror contains explicit content. Listener discretion is advised.
Okay, so we are back. It's 3 a.m. Tales of Terror, in case you forgot. I hope you didn't. Because
they probably forgot.
Yeah.
I honestly forgot about it. I'm part of the show.
So I want to like explain how we're going to do this while I'm in school, because I could not do it when I was in school. When we stopped, our last episode was in like last June, and that's when I decided to start taking two classes at a time, and I can't do that and work full time and do this podcast all at once. So what we're going to do is, while I'm out for the summer, we'll do probably once a week episodes like we were in like the very beginning. And then might be able to do one when I'm like on break or whatever. Mostly probably just during the summer until I'm out of school. Because school is more important and I don't get paid to do this. So just do it for fun.
No. Well, it's more so the fact of full-time job, student.
Yeah.
I would say taking care of the house, but you don't do shit around here. That's my job. Mm-hmm. I look good in a maid outfit, though. That's what matters.
Yeah. Okay, so anyways, this episode, the last episode we did was that random cryptids episode. I can't remember.
Dude, was it? I don't remember.
Hold on. I can't remember, like, what we had talked about, cryptids.
It was years ago. So.
It was not years ago. It was not even. Oh, we talked about like the Loveland frog, the Dover demon, the Mongolian death worm. It's all in there. So also Eli is still here and still obviously the star of the show.
No, you just needy.
Yeah, that too. So this episode though, we're gonna be talking about the exorcism of Roland Doe, which is the boy that the Exorcist movies was based off of. So it's like his story and what happened to him and how the Exorcist movie used his story for the movie. If I can talk.
Can you?
I don't know. Also, I want to give like a warning, because there's a priest in here who did, you know, he has like recordings and stuff of the, of his exorcisms, I guess, of Roland Doe. Haha. And,
Roland Doe? Was he a baker?
It's Roland Doe. That's his name. Robbie is also his name. Anyways, there's words in here when, Roland was being possessed that he said that we do not say in our personal lives or on here. So we're just going to like abbreviate them. You'll be able to figure it out. It's like, gosh darn, but the bad version of that. So
yeah, I'm not from Wisconsin. I'll just say GD.
Okay. So anyways, we will get started. I will. Are you ready?
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay. Keek looks ready. Okay. The Exorcist is a classic 1973 horror film directed by William Friedkin? I don't know how to say that last name. The film, which tells the story of a young girl who is possessed by a demonic force, is one of the highest grossing horror films of all time, and critics praised it as a truly terrifying film experience. But many people don't realize that the popular horror film was actually inspired by a true story. In the late 1940s, a 13-year-old boy, commonly known by the alias Roland Doe or Robbie Mannheim, was mourning the death of his aunt. The aunt had taught him about spiritualism, including how to use the Ouija board. Roland's family notes that strange things started happening in their house shortly after the death of his beloved family member. Roland was born into a German Lutheran family. During the 1940s, the family lived in Cottage City, Maryland. According to Allen, Roland was an only child and depended on adults in his household for playmates, primarily his Aunt Harriet. In January of 1949, the family reported hearing strange dripping noises and scratching sounds in the house. At first, Roland's mother believed the noises were connected to the dead aunt, so the family started trying to reach out to the spirits they believed to be in the house, hoping they could reason with them and ask to be left alone. That's, like, not how you'd handle that, but okay. However, this only made things worse. Shocked.
I'm surprised.
Shocked, honestly.
Shooketh.
Roland claimed he could hear someone walking in his room at night when he was trying to sleep, and there were scratch marks on his mattress in the morning. Eventually, scratch marks began also appearing on his body. According to Thomas B. Allen, after Aunt Harriet's death, the family experienced strange noises, furniture moving on its own accord, and ordinary objects such as vases flying or levitating when the boy was nearby. The family turned to their Lutheran pastor, Luther Miles Schultz, for help. Long interested in the parapsychology, Schultz arranged for the boy to spend a night in his home in order to be observed by him. When parapsychologist Joseph Banks Rhine learned that Schultz claimed he witnessed household objects and furniture seemingly moving by themselves, Rhine, quote, wondered if Schultz unconsciously exaggerated some of the facts. Schultz advised the boy's parents to, quote, see a Catholic priest. Not knowing what else they could do, the family called the local minister, and after observing the boy overnight at the church, the minister suggested they reach out to Jesuits. The family converted to Catholicism and tried to have Roland baptized, but the young boy responded to their baptism attempts with unbridled rage. At one point, Roland was admitted to a hospital where a psychiatrist attempted to treat him, but was ultimately unsuccessful. That's because it was just a psychiatrist.
Oh, fuck. Yeah, punch the shit out of the mic. That's the way.
Are you ready?
Do you want the mic that close to your face so I can you fucking breathe? Oh, you fucking mouth breather?
I didn't know if you were going to read.
But just push it away from your face.
Okay.
Just in case. It'll be okay. Idiot. All right. From there, the family thought moving Roland to a different house might make the spirits leave them alone. But the strange events continued. The family was out of options, and so they called upon priests to perform an exorcism. Father Raymond J. Bishop was one of the priests who was called in for the exorcism. Bishop later wrote about his experiences. Another priest who came to assist the family was Father William S. Bowdern. Bowdern? It says Bowdern.
Bowdern, Bowdern, maybe? I don't know.
At one point, Bowdern attempted to protect Roland through blessings and by putting a crucifix under the young boy's pillow. After leaving Roland to rest, the family returned to find furniture flipped over and the crucifix moved to the edge of the bed. Roland's mattress was shaking uncontrollably. Edward Hughes, a Roman Catholic priest, performed multiple exorcisms on young Roland Doe. One was performed at Georgetown University Hospital, a Jesuit institution. Another took place at the Alexan Brothers Hospital in South St. Louis, Missouri. While the exorcisms were performed, young Roland vomited, urinated, spit, and spoke in Latin. Ronald also took on a deep, adult-sounding voice that was unfamiliar. During the exorcism, the boy allegedly sipped...
Excuse me.
During the exorcism, the boy allegedly slipped one of his hands out of the restraints, broke a bedspring from under the mattress, and used it as an impromptu weapon, slashing the priest's arms and resulting in the exorcism ritual being halted. The family traveled to St. Louis, where Ronald... Why do I keep wanting to say Ronald? Why?
It's, I don't know.
I keep wanting to say Ronald,
there's
and I don't know why.
There's literally an L there. You're switching the L and the N.
Well, I have sex daily. I mean dyslexia. No.
Can you just please keep reading?
The family traveled to St. Louis, where Roland's cousin contacted one of his professors at St. Louis University. Bishop, who in turn spoke to William S. Bowdern, an associate of the College Church. Together, both priests visited Roland in his relatives' homes. Stop making me fucking laugh.
You don't have to put emphasis on
Roland. Together, both priests visited Roland in his relative's home, where they allegedly observed a shaking bed, flying objects, and the boy speaking in a guttural voice and exhibiting an aversion to anything sacred. Bodern was granted permission from the archbishop to perform another exorcism.
So, it's just like that song that you always sing. It's from Fast and Furious. And rolling, 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 rolling. And that from Fast and Furious?
Nope, and that's Limp Bizkit.
At least I know what I'm talking about.
No. That's not.
I know the song.
That's not in any Fast and the Furious movie, I don't believe.
Probably not. I should know. I've only seen him like a million times.
You're lucky you're a tax write-off. The final exorcism was conducted with the help of priests Walter Halloran and William Van Roo. At some point during the exorcism ritual, Halloran's nose was broken. In the end, the priests claimed they were successful in exorcising the demons from Roland's body. Oh, God. And the young boy went on to live a normal life. The exorcism took place at the Alexson Brothers Hospital in South St. Louis, Missouri, which was changed to South City Hospital. Before the next exorcism ritual began, another priest, Walter Halloran, was called to the psychiatric wing of the hospital, where he was asked to assist Bodern. William Van Roo, a third Jesuit priest, was also there to assist. Halloran stated that during this scene, words such as evil and hell, along with other various marks, appeared on the teenager's body. Allegedly, during the litany of the saints portion of the exorcism ritual, the boy's mattress began to shake. Moreover, Roland broke Halloran's nose during the process. Halloran told a reporter that after the rite was over, the anonymous subject of the exorcism went on to lead a rather ordinary life.
I think some of those paragraphs were switched around, but it's fine.
Well, I mean, we gotta exorcise the demons. You good now?
Yes. Are you good now?
I have exorcised the demons. This house is clean.
That was pretty much like the background of Roland. Okay, so now we're gonna get into the investigations and some of the explanations. So,
let's talk about Ronald McDonald.
In his 1993 book, Possessed, The True Story of an Exorcism, author Thomas B. Allen offered the consensus of today's experts that Robbie was just a deeply disturbed boy, nothing supernatural about him. Author Mark Don't think that's right either. Obsasnik? Maybe. Okay. He questioned many of the supernatural claims associated with this story, proposing that Roland Doe was simply a spoiled, disturbed bully who threw deliberate tantrums to get attention or to get out of school. Mark also reports that Halloran, who was present at the exorcism, never heard the boy's voice change, and he thought the boy merely mimicked Latin words he heard clergymen say, rather than gaining a sudden ability to speak Latin.
Which is absurdly hard to do.
Yeah, you can't just, like... I mean, if you spoke in Latin to me, I wouldn't know what you'd say, and two, I can barely do that with Spanish.
See, I don't speak Latin, though. Will does.
Okay.
I never learned Latin.
Well, I can barely do that with Spanish.
You can barely do it with English.
I know. So
English.
So I can't imagine how a 13-year-old boy is going to be able to hear.
And, like, and mimicking, I could see if it was like a couple words.
Right.
But like if you're doing an exorcism and this child is speaking fluent Latin enough to where the three Jesuit priests that are around him are going, oh shit, he's speaking Latin.
And in a
guttural adult voice.
Yeah, and in an understanding way.
Yeah, no. If it was a couple words, fine. All right, that's fair. But full-fledged sentences in a different tone of voice, and it still being like Latin to where three Jesuit priests were like, yeah, that's Latin. No.
Mm-mm.
The likelihood of that is so...
low.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. So, Opsasnik, or Mark, I'm just going to call him Mark because this last name I can't deal with. Mark reported that when marks were found on the boy's body, Halloran failed to check the boy's fingernails to see if he made the marks himself. Mark also questioned the story of Hughes' attempts to exorcise the boy and his subsequent injury, saying he could find no evidence that such an episode had actually occurred. During his investigation, Obsasnik, or Mark, discovered these six things. The exorcism did not take place at 3210 Bunker Hill Road in Mount Rainier, Maryland. The boy never lived in Mount Rainier. The boy's home was in Cottage City, Maryland, which we've already discovered. Much of the commonly accepted information about this story is based on hearsay, is not documented, and was never fact-checked. There is no evidence that Father E. Albert Hughes visited the boy's home, had him admitted to Georgetown Hospital, requested that the boy be restrained at the hospital, attempted an exorcism of the boy at Georgetown Hospital, or was injured by the boy during an exorcism or at any other time. There is ample evidence refuting claims that Father Hughes suffered an emotional breakdown and disappeared from the Cottage City community. According to Mark, individuals connected to the incident were influenced by their own specializations. To psychiatrists, Rob Doe suffered from mental illness. To priests, this was a case of demonic possession. To writers and film video producers, this was a great story to exploit for profit. Those involved saw what they were trained to see. Each purported to look at the facts, but just the opposite was true. In actuality, they manipulated the facts and emphasized information that fit their own agendas. Mark wrote that after he located and spoke with neighbors and childhood friends of the boy, most of whom he only referenced by initials, he concluded that, quote, "The boy had been a very clever trickster who had pulled pranks to frighten his mother and to fool children in the neighborhood." Skeptic Joe Nickel wrote that there was, quote, "simply no credible evidence to suggest the boy was possessed by demons or evil spirits," and maintains that the symptoms of possession can be childishly simple to fake. Nickel dismissed suggestions that supernatural forces made scratches or markings or caused words to appear on the teenager's body in unreachable places, saying a determined youth, probably even without a wall mirror, could easily have managed such a feat, if it actually occurred. Although these scratched messages proliferated, they never again appeared on the difficult-to-reach portion of the boy's anatomy. On one occasion, the boy was reportedly seen scratching the words "hell" and "Christ" on his chest using his own fingernails. Now, see, I think that's all like this. So I wrote this a long time ago. Like, I put this together a long time ago, but I think I added this in because of all of the skepticism about it. Because, like, at the same time, I like to see both sides of it, but like, I don't understand. Yeah, but
at the same time, for the Catholic Church to say yes, do an exorcism,
it takes a lot.
It takes a lot for them to do that.
It takes a lot for the Catholic Church to say yes, you can perform an exorcism. And not only did they perform, they didn't just perform one exorcism,
right?
So that also takes a lot.
So obviously, for the Catholic Church to sanction it, they'd have to have enough evidence to say, yeah, we're willing to put our name on this.
Yeah. So, if that happened, that's why I added the skepticism in there, because it just, his skepticism to me didn't make any sense, but.
According to Nickel, nothing that was reliably reported in the case was beyond the abilities of a teenager to produce. The tantrums, quote-unquote trances, moved furniture, hurled objects, automatic writing, superficial scratches, and other phenomena were just the kinds of things someone of R's age could accomplish, just as others have done before and since. Indeed, the elements of, quote-unquote, poltergeist phenomena, spirit communication, and demonic possession, taken both separately and especially together as one progressed to the other, suggest nothing so much as role-playing involving trickery.
So clearly there was a lot of skeptics around this, but, like, from our perspective, we know that the Catholic Church doesn't take exorcisms lightly, and they're not going to go in and be like, okay, yes, you can perform this exorcism. All freaking willy-nilly. Like, they're not just going to let you do that. You have to be approved by several people. So, but this is all of the skepticism that is going on. And the people who didn't really believe. And I think they were just trying to look for, like, ways that...
Debunk it.
Yeah. So...
Nickel also dismissed stories of the boy's tremendous strength, saying he showed nothing more than what could be summoned by an agitated teenager, and criticized popular accounts of the exorcism for what he termed a stereotypical storybook portrayal of the devil. Two Christian academics, Terry D. Cooper, a professor of psychology, and Cindy K. Epperson, a professor of sociology, wrote that advocates of possession believe that although they are not frequent, exorcisms are necessary for casting out the demonic, and cases of genuine possession cannot be explained by psychiatry. Cooper and Epperson devoted a chapter of their book, Evil, Satan, Sin, and Psychology, to the case and dismissed natural explanations in favor of a supernatural perspective regarding the nature of evil. Well, with that too, a lot of people think that exorcisms are needed for people that are actually having psychological issues.
Yeah.
Because you're convincing them that, hey, the reason why you are like this is because you are possessed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to cast these demons out. They did it in The Pope's Exorcist.
Oh, yeah.
They show a scene. Don't want to spoil that for anybody if you haven't seen it. Good movie. They do a scene in that where... he's performing an exorcism in this small village, mm-hmm. and slits the throat of this cow, and it's done. And he's like,
pig.
"Oh,
yeah, that's what it was. It was a pig,
the best pig that they had."
Mm-hmm.
Slit the throat, boy, magically cured. He's like, "Yeah, it wasn't demonic possession. He was just very troubled as a kid. But guess what? He's cured now, and he thinks that a demon did it. And now the demon is quote unquote gone because I have now persuaded him.
That's right.
That the demon's gone, which." That's what they were talking about in that book, obviously, was, oh, yeah, it's definitely needed to get bad things out of people because you are persuading their brain into, not compartmentalization, but what is it called? Disassociation.
Yeah, wasn't it? Well, didn't he make him think that whatever was possessing him was now in the pig?
And then the pig's throat, and then it was like, oh, demon's gone.
Yeah.
And the boy was like, I feel better.
Yeah.
Great. Fantastic. Say that's part which is also wild,
but yeah, that's where they brought the psychology part into it.
Well,
so.
I mean, it makes sense.
I mean, yeah, but still,
because you disassociate, you do bad things because you have psychological issues. I'm doing bad things, but I'm not a bad person. I'm not doing bad things. It's a demon inside me doing bad things. It potentially is not a demon. You are just having mental problems.
Yeah.
Well, if that casting out of the bad spirit makes you not do bad shit anymore. And hey, it works, whatever, cool. This exorcism case inspired the 1971 novel, The Exorcist by William Peter Blatty, which we read.
I haven't read that book, but I need to. We watched the movie. We watched the movie, but I have not read the book.
I think I read the book in high school.
I need to read the book.
Which in turn was adapted into the 1973 horror film of the same title. The case also inspired the 2000 movie Possessed, which is said to be closer to the story in Allen's book. A documentary was made of the case, titled In the Grip of Evil. Another documentary film was made in 2010, titled The Haunted Boy, The Secret Diary of the Exorcist, where a group of investigators travel to the location in question and uncover the diary that is said to be kept by William S. Bodern. In Criminal Minds, Season 4, Episode 17, Demonology, during an odd investigation into a few crimes, Agent Rossi mentions Robbie and the exorcism to Agent Prentice.
Emily Prentice? Mm-hmm. Have you seen the movie Possessed? Because I think I have.
I don't think I have.
That was pretty good. So, now we're getting into, like, the diary by Father Raymond J. Bishop. And it's pieces of it, so I'm not sure. Like, I just found it, and I don't know if it's all of it. But there are several different things in here that he recorded, he wrote down, all of the things. So we're going to get into that. And this is all obviously from his perspective because it's his diary. So, an orange and a pear flew across the entire room where R, rolling. So if we also, because a lot of this is they just didn't
write the they put the initials to save people's identities,
right? And a lot of this, there are other names that are mentioned in here, but they were all just crossed out. So I'll just, if I pause, it's because blah blah. So but R is Roland in the future. Yeah. An orange and a pear flew across the entire room where R was standing. The kitchen table was upset without any movement on the part of R. Milk and food were thrown off the table and stove. The breadboard was thrown onto the floor. Outside the kitchen, a coat on its hanger flew across the room. A comb flew violently through the air and extinguished blessed candles. A Bible was thrown directly at the feet of R, but did not injure him in any way. While the family was visiting a friend in Boonesboro, Maryland, the rocker in which R was seated spun completely around through no effort on the part of the boy. R's desk at school moved around on the floor, similar to the plate on a Ouija board. R did not continue his attendance out of embarrassment. I mean, probably wouldn't have either.
The only problem I have with that is the Bible being thrown.
Yeah.
Is because most of the time, demonic spirits, demons...
They can't touch that stuff.
It physically hurts them.
It burns them.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's like the only thing, though.
Yeah, that's kind of... I don't know. That's kind of iffy on that one. Everything else, plausible. Sure. I've had shit thrown at me in my kitchen before.
I know.
It'd be like that. I've had cigarettes thrown at me, medication, bananas... spoons, forks, shit like that at mom's house. Had it happen all the time. Cried when I was a kid. Scared the shit out of me.
I know. I don't... See, the only thing that I've ever had happen to me is... and this only ever happened at my mom's house. It hasn't happened here, and it never happened at your mom's house. I would wake up with, like, super bad paralysis. And it would feel like someone was watching me. Because, you know, my bedroom at my mom's house. It would feel like someone was watching me, and it would take everything in me to, like... try and go back to sleep, but I could not move. That was the only thing that ever happened to me. It was bad sleep paralysis, but only at her house.
That could have also been from the trauma from your childhood.
I mean, what was at the new house? Like, well,
doesn't matter. You're still young.
Yeah. No, but that happened now. Like, well, when I was living with her before we moved in together in Kernersville, it would happen.
I don't know.
And Kernersville wasn't possessed. I don't know. There was some times when I was alone in that house, and I was like...
When you were in New York, I told you after...
Oh, back, that's right.
I didn't fucking scare you. was hearing footsteps in the house and opening and closing of doors, and Eli would be in bed with me, and you were gone. So I stayed up all night in the bed, just chilling, watching videos. I was like, yeah, I'm not going to sleep. I'm good.
Yeah, but you also see shadow people on the side of the fucking road, so...
Valid.
Do you see that motherfucker right there? No, bitch! No.
I was just pointing one out when I saw it.
Don't ever do that shit again.
I'm not the only one. Go on Reddit. Shadow people are a real thing.
Yeah, that's fine. I believe that. Keep them to yourself. I don't care. I can't see them. Out of sight, out of mind. You keep them over there.
Just like the girl in the back seat.
They don't know about that.
They don't. So, we were coming home late from...
Your mom's house. It was Thanksgiving.
Is that what it was, Thanksgiving?
It was Thanksgiving dinner.
We're driving. Bad car accident on the highway coming to the house.
No, it wasn't on the highway. It was just that back road.
64 is a highway.
Oh, okay.
And so, guys out there directing traffic. Cool. We're good. There's stuff in the back seat. I think it was just some like miscellaneous stuff because we were still kind of moving into this house.
We moved into this house in October.
We passed that car accident, sitting there singing songs, you know, having a good old time. I go dead quiet. My skin crawls. My hair stands up because I felt somebody put their hand on my shoulder.
No, you asked me, you were like...
And I said, did something in the back seat move? And you said, no, there's nothing in the back seat. I said, so nothing in the back seat could have moved to touch my arm. And you said, no, why?
And then you also said that it felt like they pushed your seat forward.
No, it was they grabbed my shoulder like they were leaning forward. And then when I looked in the rearview mirror, I saw the outline of a long-haired figure. I'm going to assume it was a woman. And it was there for 30 seconds. Mm. The whole endeavor was 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm still getting fucking chills talking about it. It was crazy. And came home. It dissipated after about 35, 40 seconds. It was cool. We were right there at the house. And I was like, we're going to sit in the car for a second. Make sure everything's gone that needs to be gone. I'm not bringing it in the house just in case. Well, through investigation, when I was doing a little bit of research, because I was like, maybe I'm crazy. I was tired. I've been up all day. You know, I don't know. Because I'm a skeptic when it comes to stuff like that. And I need to have the proof of it. I looked it up. Oh, no. No, no. So truck drivers, with the research that I was doing on forums and Reddit pages and things like that. So truck drivers call them hitchhikers. And what it is when somebody dies in a car accident, they try to, quote unquote, hitch a ride in another vehicle because they're confused because they don't know they're dead yet. Later on, we find out that a woman died in that car accident.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, would you look at that?
Yeah.
That's really creepy.
So she hitched a ride. And I say, I don't know. I can't see that stuff. Thank God. I'm not upset about that at all.
And there's somebody who's not like, I'm not going to say I'm not spiritual because I'm a Christian, but
you're not.
I'm skeptical yes. of ghost spirits, things like that. Even though I've had so many encounters with it, I'm just still super skeptical about it. Why is shit always going to happen to me, huh?
I don't know. As long as it happens to you and not me, that's fine. I got like 6 Bibles in this room.
Well, see, and I didn't want to scare you.
You didn't anyways.
Like if you're in a car, you're like in the back seat, and you want to lean forward, like change the radio station or whatever, and you grab both seats to pull forward, that is what it felt like on my right arm.
Yeah, and then you were like, can you look in the back seat? And I'm like, yeah.
There's nobody back there, right? And you're no, like, why? Like,
why would there nobody? Why would there be somebody back there?
Well, I didn't want to freak you out.
Because it was also like 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah, and I didn't want to scare you. There's no point in scaring you about it.
You did. Congratulations.
It scared me just because I did not expect it to happen. It wasn't like it was a bad presence or anything like that. It just scared me feeling an arm on my shoulder and then looking up and seeing a shadow person in my fucking car. Yeah, not great.
Yeah. I don't see that, and I hope to God I never do.
I've seen shadow people for a while. It's not a big deal.
Yeah, that's...
They never fucked with me. That's what I told you. That's why it scared me, because they've never gotten that close. They always... driving down the road, standing on the side of the road. I see him sometimes when I'm walking, shit like that. Not a big deal. And then, boom, there's one in my back seat. Hell no.
Yeah, no. I mean, it wouldn't have gotten in this house very far anyways, because this house is blessed, and there's a crucifix right there, so.
Well, I mean, duh. But, yeah, caught a hitchhiker, so there you go.
Yeah.
But anyway, going back to the Bible and all that stuff, I just don't see the Bible being very plausible. It's like in movies when the crosses turn upside down.
Yeah.
That's not satanic.
No, it's not. I think we've talked about that before, too, though.
Yeah, because it pisses me off. Because they're like, ooh, scary upside down cross. You mean the cross of St. Peter?
Yeah.
Because he said that he wasn't good enough to be crucified the same way Jesus Christ was, so he wanted to be crucified upside down. Which is a worse death, by the way. 10 times worse. Being crucified already is an awful fucking way to die. And then you're going to be crucified upside down on top of that. You drown in your own blood is what happens. You suffocate to death drowning in your own blood because your chest fills with all of your fluids.
Mm-mm.
And it is slow.
Yeah.
Like days.
Ew.
Yeah. Yeah, like days.
Oh my God. So anyways, that's what happened to him. Okay. So this is a day-by-day event that happened in St. Louis.
St. Louis!
Monday, March 7th. That's my grandma's birthday. Not 1949. Her birthday is 1942.
You really had to look at your tattoo?
Yeah, I did.
To remember the year?
Well, because I have 1942 and 1944, and I know my grandma was older than my grandpa. It's like having information on your skin. Have that.
Is that what tattoos are?
They do!
Did you guys know that tattoos are information on your skin? I just learned this. As somebody who doesn't have any tattoos, I would not have known that.
Yeah. Not a single one.
No, not. I don't have a single tattoo. That is factual. I have multiple.
God. Okay, so anyways, Monday, March 7th, 1949. Home of R's non-Catholic aunt and uncle. 5 or 6 relatives were present. Spirit questioned through an alphabetical medium on a porcelain table. Letters of the alphabet written on paper were underlined whenever the table moved. A code of messages became evident. Phenomena indicated that the spirit was not the devil, but the soul of the deceased. And there's a name there, but it's X'd out. Spirit confirmed to all present that she was the soul of the deceased ex by moving a heavy bed 2 or 3 feet with no one of the bystanders near the bed. All the group saw this action. Furthermore, writing appeared on R's body while he was reading a comic book. There was a sharp pain. The writing was done through his clothes. When R retired, there was a violent shaking of the bed and scratching on the mattress. Hardly any relief through the night. And so I'm assuming, because these are just like snippets that he wrote down and they just put it all together. So some of them might not sound like complete sentences, but you know, it's just what
happened. He was probably sitting there documenting it while it was going on.
Mm-hmm. So if it sounds like that, that's the way it's written, because that's the way he wrote it.
Yeah, it's not really like a diary. It's more of like a...
Remember.
A notepad, I guess, is mm-hmm. how you would describe it. Like a cheat sheet. Just,
yeah.
All right, this is what's happening now.
This is what happened.
All right,
now.
And then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened.
Yeah. Okay, so Wednesday, March 9th. At home as of Tuesday, Father Bishop blessed the entire house and used a special blessing in R's room and on his bed. A second-class relic of St. Margaret Mary was safety-pinned to the corner of R's pillow. Shortly after R retired, the mattress on his bed began to move back and forth in the direction of the bed upright. The boy lay perfectly still and did not exert any physical effort. The movement in one direction did not exceed more than 3 inches. The action was intermittent and completely subsided after a period of approximately 15 minutes. When Father Bishop sprinkled St. Ignatius, is that how you say that? Ignatius, holy water on the bed in the form of a cross, the movement ceased quite abruptly but began again when Father stepped out of the room. During the course of the 15 minutes of activity, a sharp pain seemed to have struck R on his stomach and he cried out. The mother quickly pulled back the bed covers and lifted the boy's pajama top enough to show a zigzag scratch in bold red lines on the boy's abdomen. It should be remarked that during the 15 minutes, the boy was not out of view of 6 observers. When the mattress shaking subsided, there was peace for the remainder of the night after 11:15 p.m. I think they did that. They actually put that in the Exorcist movie. I think that happened to that girl in that movie with the scratches on her belly and stuff. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it did, because they ripped up her... Because in the movie, you can see it being written.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In her guts.
Yeah. Okay. Wednesday, March 16th. So this is a week later. Permission was granted by the Most Reverend Archbishop Joseph E. Ritter that Father William S. Bodern, S.J., pastor of the College Church in St. Louis, might read the prayers of exorcism according to the Roman ritual. Father Bodern began the prayers of exorcism. R was awake, and the overhead light in the bedroom kept burning. R kept his hand outside the bed covers. On the first precipio, there was immediate action. 3 large parallel bars were scratched on the boy's stomach. The most distinct markings on the body were the picture of the devil on R's right leg and the word hell imprinted on R's chest in such a way that R could look down upon his chest and read the letters plainly. To the question, how many demons? A single line was scratched on R's leg. There were at least 4 heavy brand marks in the form of an X. This impression may have indicated that the exorcism would take 10 days or that the devil would depart at 10 o'clock. Friday, March 18th, 2 days later, R had a spell about 1 p.m. His father held him tight in his arms while the mother and aunt prayed the rosary. The struggling ceased in about 1 hour after Father Bodern, Bishop, and Mr. Halloran, S.J., arrived at R's home at 7 p.m. So 6 hours. Next, the fathers began the litany of the saints, as indicated in the exorcism ritual. In the course of the litany, the mattress began to shake. R was awake. The shaking ceased when Father Bodern blessed the bed with holy water. The prayers of the exorcism were continued, and R was seized violently so that he began to struggle with his pillow and the bed clothing. The arms, legs, and head of R had to be held by 3 men. Also, just a reminder that he is 13 years old.
Now, granted.
I know.
It took 3 nurses, my mother and father, to hold me down when I had to get, forget what it was that was stuck in my hand that was causing an infection, but they couldn't put me under for it.
Let me see if I can find a picture of what he looked like.
The doctor had to dig into the palm of my hand. I think I was 12 or 13, and it took my father, my mother, and 2 or 3 nurses. And I think the doctor to hold my hand, because I was freaking out. Now, granted, I'm a big boy. And at 13, I was pretty big.
Yeah, this is the only picture.
What does the kid look like?
That's the only picture I can find.
He's pretty standard.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if that was him at 13.
I don't know. 3 men, that seems pretty average. That's not very extraordinary.
Yeah. Still, I don't know.
I mean, it's just not. Now, if it was like 6 guys to hold this kid down to this bed, yeah.
Yeah.
That's pushing it.
Right.
But, I mean, that's not.
The contortions revealed physical strength beyond the natural power of R. R spit at the relics and at the priest's hands. He writhed under the sprinkling of holy water. He fought and screamed in a diabolical, high-pitched voice during one of his quieter reactions. He was moving his feet in rhythmical fashion. Father Beldern held the Blessed Sacrament 3 or 4 inches from the sole of the moving foot. The movement stopped on the foot, which was nearer the Blessed Sacrament. The manifestation of the power of the Blessed Sacrament showed up time after time without fail. And Saturday, March 19th, one day later, when the exorcist asked for a sign through the prayer on 3 or 4 different occasions, R urinated, seemingly without control. He complained upon waking up that the urine burned him. Previous to the urination, R doubled with pain in his stomach and he woke up crying. He complained, too, that his throat hurt him. Now you get to read some of the recordings by Bishop, if you feel like it, with Eli in your lap.
He's just a needy boy.
He is.
I'll try. Oh, it says possible recording by the bishop. It is worthy of mention that God seemed to have pity on the boy who became... And it says unintelligible, so if I just kind of stop abruptly, it's because it gets cut out. The devil was not permitted to disturb R after he had fallen into... The violence followed on the prayers of the exorcism. The high evenings were urination, which really burned R. Breaking wind, rectum 3 different times, and the cursing of the exorcists. Some of the vulgarity follows. Get away from me, you assholes. Go to hell, you dirty sons of bitches. GD you, sons of bitches. You dirty assholes. And occasionally R would use prayers to Mary and Our Lady of Fatima. Action ceased at 2 a.m. Father Bodern arranged that R might have a room at the college church rectory.
This is Wednesday, March 23rd, so this is the next Wednesday.
Okay. My bad.
Sorry, I didn't put a space there.
2 beds were provided so that R's father might sleep in the same room with his son. R took brief instruction on the Catholic religion and then went to bed at 9:30 p.m. Short acts of faith, hope, and love and contrition were received by all the group, including R. Immediately upon the first innovations of the litany, R went into his tantrum. He fought and kicked and spit so that 3 men could scarcely hold him. In the course of the evening, R broke Mr. Halloran's nose and caused Father Rue's nose to bleed. The first blows were accurate, quick, and deadly, although R's eyes were shut. At the Precipio, R urinated rather copiously and on coming to himself complained of the burning sensation. There were 4 or 5 such urinations during the evening. Several times there was passing wind through the rectum. So he was peeing and farting. Passing wind through the rectum.
You do that a lot. You do that a lot.
Better out than in.
Oh my God. I just copied and pasted. That's what it says. It's professional.
Professional. He tooted.
He
demonically tooted.
Stop.
The language of R became abusive and dirty. He met one of the fathers in hell and stated the year as 1957. He indicated surprise at finding the father in hell. The vile and filthy talk which followed makes anyone shudder. R spoke of his penis as a beautiful pecker, a willy dilly pilly, so round, so firm, with a red top and a hole in the middle. He pulled the towel from his loins and shook his body in a suggestive and shimmy fashion. His expressions were lowly and smacked of the abuse of sex. When R came to normal from time to time, he would say that the men down there were using filthy language. R was never accustomed to filthy expressions in his regular life. With more contortions, barking, and singing, R finally went off into a natural sleep at 2:30 a.m. Why you gotta give me the part where he describes his pecker?
No.
At the rectory, reactions began.
Thursday, March 24th, you were going in order. This is a day-by-day event.
Sorry, I'm caught up on, like, rectum and rectory is, like, in this, like, 95 times.
Oh, God.
At the rectory, reactions began at 9:45 p.m. and continued until 2:30 a.m. Father Bishop thought that this would be the next night since it was the Feast of St. Gabriel. What did I say?
The next night.
That doesn't sound right. The next day was the Feast of the Annunciation. Father Bodern believed that the X mark on R from the last night of the exorcism should be interpreted as the 10th day, so he did not expect the devil to leave until the following night. R had great physical strength. Four men were holding him. R ran the gamut of shouting, screaming, barking, singing, kindly expressions, urinating, and passing foul air. Tooting.
Stop.
One of the assisting fathers was met in hell in 1956. He was called a big fat ass and an ox. Michael, the workman who helped R, was constantly in R's bitter imprecations or in silly rhymes. Michael, pickle, lickle, sickle. Michael, you look so dirty. The filthiest talk was given out after midnight on the Feast of the Annunciation. R spoke of kissing his pecker.
Hold on, just... It gets a little bit, like, just, if you have kids, I would have just be careful. It's not terrible, and it's nothing we wouldn't say otherwise, but it can get a little vulgar.
I mean, I cuss this entire podcast.
So I mean, like, yeah, I know, but still.
Then he would say, R spoke of kissing his pecker and using the stick for pleasure. Then he would say, isn't it pretty? He turned upon the priest at his bedside. You have big pricks too, and you'd like to rub them up and down. You have big teats, you big ox. Then followed a sucking sound. He called on the exorcist to cut out the damned Latin, get away from me, you GD bastards. About 2 a.m., R noted from his tantrums that the bystanders were going to stay to the end. In a coy tone, he remarked, you like to stay with me. Well, I like it too. The Blessed Sacrament had no noticeable effect in the course of the night. He slept from 2:30 to 11:30 a.m.
Goodness. Okay, so that was Thursday, March 24th, and now it goes to April 18th. This is also the last little bit. So this Monday, April 18th, is going in a time frame. So, 8 a.m., R awoke in a spell, kicking at the brother at the bedside. He jumped out of bed, seized the holy water bottle, threatened to throw it at the brothers, then sprinkled water toward them. Finally, he threw the bottle over their heads, smashing it against the ceiling. 8:15 a.m., Father Widman attempted to give R communion. It was impossible. Spitting, unable to make even spiritual communion, made one spiritual communion. The devil then seized him and said that one devil was out and that R had to make 9 communions, sacramental or spiritual, apparently, and then he would leave his body. R continued for about an hour, unable to make spiritual communion or to receive the sacrament. The more I say communion, the more I'm going to mess it up, I feel like. 10 a.m. There were more spells when attempting spiritual communion. R was able to say, I wish to receive you. That is all the priest attempted to have him say, since it was sufficient. The devil laughed and said, that isn't enough. He has to say one more word. One little word. I mean one big word. He'll never say it. He has to make 9 communions. He'll never say that word. I am always with him. I may not have much power always, but I am in him. He'll never say that word. 11:30 a.m. R said he was very hungry and wanted a bath and food. We put him off until noon. They gave him a tray, cake, ice cream, milk. He threw the glass against the wall, scattering broken glass all over. Violence was intermittent until about 1:30 p.m. R was very discouraged and disgusted and mean. R went into a spell while he held the book on his knees, and immediately the book was thrown into the corner of the room. From 9:30 until 10 p.m., R was in and out of seizures. During his quiet moments, the most impressive prayer of the evening was R's relevance seemed truly remarkable. At 10:45 p.m., the most striking event of the evening occurred. R was in a seizure, but lay calm. In clear, commanding tones, and with dignity, a voice broke into the prayers. The following is an accurate quotation. Satan, Satan, I am Saint Michael, and I command you, Satan, and the other evil spirits, to leave the body in the name of Dominus immediately. Now, now, now. Then there were the most violent contortions of the entire period of exorcism, that is, since March 16th. Perhaps this was the fight to the finish. Father O'Flaherty and the brothers were weary and sore physically from the exertion. After 7 or 8 minutes of violence, R, in a tone of complete relief, said, "He's gone." Immediately, R came back to normal and said he felt fine. R now explained what he saw. He said there was a brilliant white light, and in that light stood a very beautiful man with flowing wavy hair that blew in the breeze. He wore a white robe that fitted close to his body. The material gave the impression of scales. Only the upper half of the body of this man was visible to R. In his right hand, he held up a wavy and fiery sword in front of him. With his left hand, he pointed down to a pit or cave. R said he saw the devil standing in the cave. R felt the heat from the cave and saw the flames. First, the devil fought, resisting the angel and laughing diabolically. Then the angel smiled at R and spoke, but R only heard one word, Dominus. As the angel spoke, the devil and about 10 of his helpers ran back into the fire of the cave or pit. After the devil disappeared, the letters SPITE appeared on the bars of the cave. As the devils disappeared into the pit, R felt a pulling or tugging in the region of his stomach. As the devils disappeared, he felt a snapping and then felt relaxed completely. He said that this was the most relaxed feeling he had had since the whole experience began in January. R relates his visual experience at 11 p.m. This was approximately the time that the manifestations of the devil began in Cottage City, Maryland, on the evening of January 15th, 1959. Tuesday, April 19th. R was awakened from a heavy sleep and taken to the chapel where he attended the first Holy Mass since he became a Catholic. He likewise received Holy Communion and at the altar rail with no difficulty. R promised to say 10 rosaries in thanksgiving to Our Lady of Fatima during the course of the day. Since Monday at 11 p.m., there have been no indications of the presence of the devil. That was dated the Feast of St. Mark, April 25th, 1949. And then a small follow-up. August 19th, 1951, R and his father and mother visited the brothers. R, now 16, is a fine young man. His father and mother also became Catholic, having received their first Holy Communion on Christmas Day in 1950. So, what do you think?
I think they exorcised the demons.
Probably.
I don't know. It's 50-50.
Yeah.
Some of the shit sounds a little BS-y.
Yeah.
But again, for the Catholic Church to get so many priests involved and performing that many exorcisms, and then checking up on the kid afterwards.
Yeah.
I'd have to say it was real.
Yeah, and then his whole family is now Catholic and attending Catholic Church, so, and communions and masses.
Well, most of the time, Catholic exorcisms, they want you...
They want you to do it so they can keep an eye on you and make sure.
Well, no, it's not even that. It's just the fact of... They seem like if you join the Catholic faith while we're doing this exorcism, it's a lot easier for you to help us because you're now a Catholic.
Right. Well, I guess that's it for this episode. We're going to try and do weekly episodes during the summer, just so that you guys can have a little bit more. And I'm not, we're not really that busy.
I'm busy. I have to do stuff.
That's
we don't all get to like wake up, be an indoor cat.
Okay. So anyways, probably once a week. I have next week's episode already out, like already written out and planned. Mm-hmm. So we're good.
That's good.
Yeah. Also,
next week episode? You mean this week's episode?
Next week's episode. This is this week's episode.
It's Saturday.
This episode is dropping on Monday, the 13th. So the next episode will be Monday.
Oh, the 20th.
Yeah.
That's 7 days. 13 plus 7, 20.
Okay. So anyways, my resources for this story were fox4kc.com, Wikipedia, novelsuspects.com, and atgtickets.com. So, is there anything else you would like to say?
No, not really.
Okay. All right. Well, then I guess we'll
wrap it up.
Okay. Oh, also, I don't have a website because I'm not paying for that anymore. So you can... We still have the Facebook up, we still have Instagram up, and we still have the email info@3amtalesofterror.com. So if you have any questions or story ideas that you want to send to us, feel free to reach out on either of those three platforms. I also have a TikTok that I haven't really used, all of which are at 3amtalesofterror. So feel free to reach out to any of those if you have any... If you have any, like, story ideas or questions or anything like that, send them to the email info@3amtalesofterror. Either way, it doesn't matter. But those are the ways that you can currently reach us. And I probably won't be making a website, so we'll just keep up with social media. It seems to be a lot easier. And also, we're still on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, and most... I mean, those are the major podcast platforms, but I think we're on a few others, too, in case you listen to other ones, so... Other than that, we will see you next time, and we hope you enjoyed the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, bye.
Deuces.